From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello, thank you for joining us. Our guest this week, Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor for National Journal. J.J. Green, he's national correspondent for WTOP Radio here in Washington, also host of Target USA. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today, Dow Jones and West Wing Reports. And here are the issues for this week. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump is accelerating with the first publicly televised hearings and some dramatic new developments. Unrest in the South American nation of Bolivia, even as the self-declared interim president calls for quick elections after former President Evo Morales resigned and fled the country. And at least one university in Hong Kong is shutting its doors for the remainder of the school year in the face of escalating anti-government violence. Well, let's start, obviously, with the big story this week, which is this accelerating impeachment inquiry into President Trump. For the first time, televised hearings, which are giving the American people the opportunity to really hear for themselves from some of these witnesses, some of whom were actually hired by President Trump, who are now giving evidence against him. Let's just get right to it. How have these first couple of days gone for the president and his defenders and for those who seek to impeachment? JJ, we'll start with you.
This is an onion with many layers. A lot of those layers have already been peeled back, but the ones that are being revealed now are revealing very sensitive elements. Not only is it information that is sensitive, but it's also people's feelings, people's lives, people's jobs. We're getting into the crux of some of the things that have been driving, I think, this problem that has been a divide between, you know, certain elements of the nation. And to be honest about it, we're also seeing an international layer peeled back, too. And we're starting to see, if we haven't already noticed it in recent years, we're starting to see this nervousness that many of the U.S.'s allies are starting to exhibit now, specifically because they're concerned about how far this is going to go, where it's going to end up, and when it does end, where will it leave them?
Okay, we're going to get into sort of the foreign policy aspect of that in just a minute. Very important angle to talk about. But Tom, I want to get to your brief thoughts, too. Again, we've had a couple days now of these televised hearings. And just by way of background for our listeners, by the way, Tom covered Richard Nixon's impeachment hearings in 1973 and 1974. The president, of course, resigned before he could actually be impeached. And then you also covered Bill Clinton's impeachment some 21 years ago. Now, here we are, a third go around for you. What do you think?
Well, it really is, as they say, deja vu all over again, twice. Although I think the most important thing that's happened in this round of impeachment hearings is that faces have been put together with charges. I mean, President Trump and his defenders have said that the people making these charges are never Trumpers, meaning people who hate the president. And
but he hired a lot of these people.
That's the point. I think the most impressive witness in the first go-around was William Taylor, who has served his country for 50 years, starting as a West Point graduate, starting as a lieutenant in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division, and he's been a diplomat for more than 40 years. He was ambassador to Ukraine, but when the Trump administration fired Ambassador Yovanovitch, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, begged Taylor to come back and take his old job back as ambassador to Ukraine. So the Trump administration hired him to come back. And so to call him a biased partisan never Trumper is not working out very well. So to me, it's been fairly compelling testimony, I have to say. But of course, in the Republicans, they do what President Trump does. They try to deflect. They try to change the subject. And they've scored a few points. They do say that all the allegations are hearsay. But, of course, they don't point out, these Republicans, that people with firsthand knowledge of what the president was thinking have been blocked by the president from testifying. So there's some cynicism here on both sides of the aisle. But I think, on balance, the first few days of hearings have not been great for President Trump. They haven't sunk him irretrievably, but they advantage Democrats in the early going.
Now, the president, for his part, were obligated to give his point of view here is been giving thesaurus quite a workout, saying that these hearings are a sham, a hoax, a witch hunt, all of the normal things that we've come to expect from him. He says he has not done anything wrong whatsoever. And all of these other people, as you say, Tom, some of whom he actually hired to come and work for him, all of them are wrong and he alone is correct. What do you think about that, JJ?
Well, I think, as Tom said, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you see what's coming out of the mouths of people who actually worked for this administration, and you see this coming from career diplomats. You see this coming from people who are not carpetbaggers or fly-by-nighters. You see essentially a situation where information is being matched up with timelines. You know, there are telephone calls that people have overheard, and there are also situations where information, you know, is being contested that there is proof of to some degree. Talk about the telephone call, their situation room in the White House. You know, was there a top secret server? Well, yes, there was. Was this information moved to the server? Yes. Why was it? Okay. So then you have people who say, well, this didn't happen in a vacuum. This was put in place in August when the White House was concerned about other leaks from the White House. When you have this whistleblower coming forward now and other people along with this individual saying the same things, it's a difficult situation to contest. But that's what this situation is all about when you talk about impeachment on a possible trial in the Senate. Unless you say I'm guilty, then you're going to say, no, I didn't do it.
The Democrats have adopted a new strategy. We've probably learned more about Latin in the last month or so than at any time in our career. Quid pro quo is a phrase, Latin phrase, meaning something for something. And the allegation has been that President Trump offered the Ukrainian president a quid pro quo, which is, if you launch an investigation of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, who had a very juicy contract with the Ukrainian energy company, if you investigate them, we'll give you $400 million in military and foreign assistance. Trump keeps saying no quid pro quo. Well, the Democrats have now decided to use another word, bribery. And the reason they're going to call this bribery is that bribery is one of the specific alleged crimes in the Constitution that allow Congress to impeach a president. The Constitution says a president can be removed from office for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So it's not a coincidence that the Democrats are now saying the president committed bribery.
And that word, of course, used publicly for the first time this week by Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker. Now, JJ, one thing you mentioned before, which is very important that I wanted to come back to. JJ, by the way, I gave Tom a plug. JJ, listeners should know that JJ is one of the premier national security journalists in the United States. And I want you to respond to one newspaper story written about some of the testimony as it pertains to foreign policy. And it's showed that Trump was, quote, abandoning our commitment to Ukraine as an important strategic ally. And then it adds, quote, it's the latest example of the president tilting U.S. foreign policy in the direction of helping Russia at the expense of our traditional allies, unquote. And then it goes on to give several examples of what he has done. The broader implications of what's going on here, it's not just withholding aid for Ukraine, probably to curry favor with the Russians, but all of these other things. Are we beyond questioning at this point whether the president is in fact tilting American foreign policy towards the Russians? It's hard to believe we're even talking about this, you know, anecdote after anecdote after anecdote that appears to suggest just that.
Well, I don't know who wrote that article or where it comes from. And thank you for the plug, by the way. But, you know, if you look at the president, most of the people that work for him and a lot of the people that observe him and allies view him as a businessman that is president. And he does everything from a business point of view. And you're a business guy. You understand what this is all about. The problem with this process, though, is why does he never take on Putin? Why does he never criticize Putin or what he's doing in that process? And there are these folks, allies, that are very upset about what this suggests to them. It suggests that there is an agenda against them, U.S. allies, that he's putting forward. But the bottom line on most likely what the president, according to people I've been speaking to, may be thinking in his mind is pragmatism. What's best for what it is that I would like to achieve right now, as opposed to what's best for the nation and what's best for the U.S.'s allies. It's a pragmatism that seems to be focused on business acumen, and I'm not sure that it's working for the U.S. allies. Several were here from Eastern Europe a couple of weeks ago. I had some long conversations with them, and the bottom line on it for them is that they are very nervous because they're members of NATO, and they are wondering if this whole situation with President Trump, the whole problem with Russia lurking in the background, is going to tilt the balance of power away from them, so that if they need help at some time in the near future, will they get it from the U.S.?
Now, before we move on, we could talk about this for quite some time here, but Tom, I want you to briefly give our listeners, if you could, kind of a sense of the timeline for how all of this is going to unfold, and what do you think the impact, based on what we've seen so far, will be on the 2020 election?
It's a little premature to, obviously, to know about the 2020 election. Republicans, and I hear this consistently from Republicans whom I trust, who say, remember I told you this. In October or November of 2019, these impeachment proceedings will guarantee President Trump's re-election a year from now. The Democrats obviously beg to differ. The timeline is the Democrats would like to wrap up these hearings in the next month or so and have a vote before they go home for Christmas and New Year's. I'm not sure that that will work because there are some witnesses the Democrats really want to hear from, but they have said we won't come unless a court compels us to come, and I don't think a court is going to make that determination for a while. But I suspect in the end, whatever your political point of view, I think it's likely that the democratically controlled House will impeach President Trump. And sometime after the first of the year, there will be a trial in the Senate. And at the moment, I think there's no way the Republican senators are going to abandon Trump for a variety of reasons, mainly because they're terrified if they cross him that he will destroy their re-elections. But anyway, I mean, I think the odds are strong that President Trump will be the third American president impeached, the first being Andrew Johnson after the Civil War and the second being Bill Clinton. So it's not clear whether impeachment is going to certify Trump's re-election or whether it's going to damage him. I think both sides are very polarized here now, Paul.
You could make a case either way.
Right. There's probably 15% to 20% of the electorate that is still trying to decide what they think.
Okay. Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTO. And host of Target USA, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. The South American nation of Bolivia has an interim president. Her name is Jeanine Anez Chavez, whose government has now been recognized by the United States, Britain, Brazil, and other world powers. She takes over for Evo Morales, who fled the country last weekend and has been given asylum in Mexico. Bolivia, just by way of background, has been in turmoil for about a month now after elections in October. Chavez told the BBC this week that Morales should be prosecuted if he ever returns to Bolivia. Now, JJ, you know a little bit something about Bolivia. Why did Morales resign in the first place and leave the country?
Well, the reason he resigned was because he was caught essentially fabricating votes. This is a situation that it's really interesting. Hopes and dreams are the things that make one successful. That's what life is all about, in my opinion, my own opinion. And when you put people in a nation in a place where they can't achieve those hopes and dreams, which, by the way, they had when he came to power some years ago, they've evaporated, then they get restless, then they get unhappy. And what happened was he wanted to stay in power. And apparently there was a situation where the vote situation there didn't line up with reality. So he was then put in a scenario where he had to leave the country. Now, the real interesting thing about this is that there are three countries in that region that have all been a part of an axis that's been a problem. The first one was Ecuador. And Ecuador, the leadership has changed there. There's this one, Bolivia. That leadership has changed. The next one is Venezuela. The thing that I'm getting to here is the pendulum of power always swings back. This situation has been in place for a while. It's swinging back the other way. Morales recognized it, so he got out.
Tom?
It's very unlikely that Morales will ever come back to Bolivia, certainly not in the foreseeable future. And, of course, he has been denouncing from exile in Mexico City what he describes as racists and coup leaders who are now running Bolivia, not talking, of course, about the fact that the United States very quickly supported the new leaders of Bolivia and recognized them right away. Morales has said that he will return if the people ask me. Well, I don't think he should be holding his breath. Ultimately, it was more than just wanting to stay in power, which JJ is right about. I think there was a feeling on the part of many Bolivian voters that Morales had become corrupt, personally corrupt. And so his political support diminished, and I don't think he'll be back. I don't think a Morales comeback is in the cards.
J.J. made a good point about sort of unrest in many countries in South America, plus Chile, of course, big demonstrations there as well. Very important country there, too. But let's move on to China and Hong Kong. At least one university in Hong Kong, of course, used to be a British colony until 1997. One university there is now shutting its doors for the rest of the school year in the face of these escalating anti-government violence. These protests have been going on for many months now, and they appear to pose, I think, perhaps the biggest challenge to Chinese President Xi Jinping since he came to power in 2012. JJ, boil these protests down, if you could, to their essence. Students in Hong Kong and others are demonstrating, or demanding rather, greater freedoms, less intrusion from communist China next door.
They're looking for a Hong Kong spring. Simple. What they're looking for is to put their stamp on this point in time that we're living in, letting China, Beijing rather, and the rest of the world, as a matter of fact, know, putting the rest of the world on notice that they are not going to back down from what it is that they want. And that is essentially more freedom, and they don't want the heavy hand of Beijing hanging over them. The problem with this process is there are those amongst them that are instigators, just like the situation in Chile is, and in other places around the world, and I'm not going to take much time on this, I'm just going to say there are those that are mixed in with these protesters that are not necessarily on their side. They're there to instigate. The objective here for Beijing is to get Hong Kong back before they're supposed to get it back. And they have been looking for an opportunity to exert themselves on the world stage and their power. And this is one way they figure perhaps we can eliminate a huge thorn in our side by doing this sooner than later. The protesters also have to realize, and I think they're probably going to very soon, that there's a limit to what they can achieve by these types of protests.
Is there any risk of kind of a Tiananmen Square crackdown, bloody and violent and that kind of thing?
Well, I think we've seen it. We just haven't seen the totality of a Tiananmen Square. We've seen several acts of violence within the last couple of weeks, and certainly this week. We're moving up to that point where Beijing's going to have to make a decision. Are we going to do a big-time crackdown, or are we going to try to do some more diplomatic dialogue here?
Now, Tom, what is the American stake here? Human rights is not a big subject for President Trump, but issues like a trade deal with China is a big deal for him. He also wants to secure Beijing's help, of course, in dealing with North Korea. So he's kind of juggling a lot of priorities, and the sense is that standing up for human rights in Hong Kong are not very high on his list.
They're very low on his list, to put it mildly. He's got a problem, President Trump, as you just eloquently laid out there. He doesn't want to irritate the Chinese because he needs a trade deal for his Trump's political purposes. He sees a deal with the Chinese is not only good for American commerce, but good for his re-election prospects. So he doesn't want to irritate the Chinese, and it's pretty clear that the Chinese are kind of crazed about the notion of American interference in what they consider to be China's internal affairs. And I think President Xi has said more than once privately to the president, shut up, butt out, we don't want to hear you talking about this. So President Trump, you're right, has been very mild about this. He basically says, I think this is a subject for Hong Kong and China to work out, and we hope there's not further violence. So it's basically a ceding of the field to Beijing. And the real question is, how much dissent and how much violence and bloodshed will President Xi tolerate, because more violence and more bloodshed is almost certain to happen. I mean, the Chinese have not lived up to the promises of the deal they made with Great Britain in 1997. They said that Hong Kong would keep its freedoms and would be allowed more freedoms. Well, that's just baloney.
They've gradually been whittling away for the last 20
years. Right. They've been eroding.
Right.
Recently, one of the more prominent pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong was banned from running for office in Hong Kong, and the Chinese leaders just decided he could not run for election, and that's not exactly adhering to the principles of the deal with the UK. So the Chinese are basically saying, we're going to do what we want, take your best shot, but we're not going to tolerate this. So the real question, as I said earlier, is how much bloodshed is Xi ready to tolerate, because more is coming if this continues on this track.
The other reason, I think, why Beijing is trying to speed up the timeline is because they recognize that the UK is distracted right now. There's Brexit, and they realize that the US is distracted, and that's with this impeachment and other things that have been the Mueller probe beforehand. But what's the common denominator between those two countries, those two powers? It's Russia. And Beijing recognizes this. Beijing is very clear that the more we can get done, and so is Russia, and so are the rest of the U.S.'s adversaries. They all recognize the more we can get done while this time exists where there's this chaos and there's this unrest and these powers are not settled, and the more we can get done now, the better for us. And that's a part of the reason in my mind why Beijing may be trying to speed this timeline up.
And we've got just a couple of minutes left here, Tom, and you made an interesting point that President won't talk about human rights in Hong Kong or really anywhere else, if we can be honest here, because he wants this, obviously, a trade deal with China. But there's no sign that this trade deal is really forthcoming. I mean, they talk about kind of a phase one deal, but now we keep hearing this balk about who's going to buy what from farmers and everything. I mean, what's the update on the trade deal?
Well, I will be a little more cynical than I like to be. I think the Trump administration goes up the hill, goes down the hill. When the president says that the trade talks are doing well, the stock market goes up. When the Chinese say, well, we didn't commit to buying whatever the million tons of soybeans are, the stock market goes down. And the president, I personally don't think that we're close to a trade deal, but I certainly could be wrong. And if there is a trade deal, even a so-called phase one, that will help. But I think there's just too much distance between the two, especially on the question of theft of intellectual property, which the Chinese are the biggest thieves in the world on intellectual property. And I think the president doesn't want to go down that road. China in the United States is a problem to be managed by the U.S., and I don't know how this is going to sort out.
And probably in about 30 seconds or so, the other big thing he needs, obviously, is greater help from China with respect to North Korea. Now, Trump says, oh, things with North Korea are going great. He said 2 years ago they were disarming, but they're not. What's the status quickly in terms of a North Korea, JJ?
North Korea says yesterday that they expect to talk again with the U.S. sometime in December. The U.S. hasn't said anything about that yet that I know of concretely. But I will say this about North Korea and China. China recognizes that North Korea is a useful tool. And they realize as well, again, back to this idea of distractions. They also realize that this is a good time for that to be going on. They're not doing a whole lot to resolve it, because what they want is for the U.S. to be in a situation where it's got multiple issues on multiple fronts that it's dealing with, so perhaps it'll miss something that China or others are doing that are favorable to China.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. Also, J.J. Green. He's national correspondent for WTOP Radio here in Washington, also host of Target USA. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports, USA Today, and Dow Jones. Thanks very much for joining us.